it doesn't matter what degree you've got or where you want to go. These are really important skills that you should start to cultivate now.
What are some of the skills that you believe people are going to need to possess to really get ahead in this new way of working?
First is the digital literacy. This means proficiency in using digital tools, understanding data, staying informed about advancements in AI, in automation, in cloud computing, being selective about the tools that you want to dive into and making sure that they're relevant for where you want to go and for your career and your industry. The second part of that is relational intelligence, right? The smartest person in the room is not the most successful. It's not the most well-liked either. It's the person with the best people skills. They're not soft at all. They are critical and they're much harder to build than technical skills. Qualities such as curiosity, adaptability, critical thinking, collaboration. And my favorite quote is from Alvin Toffler. And he said, "The literate of the future won't be those that cannot read or write, but those that cannot learn, relearn, and unlearn."
Friska, welcome to the Career Confidence Podcast today. I am really excited to have you on. We were just having a very quick chat before we press record, and you've written a book which I am really excited to unpack and really sort of unpack the chapters and the strategies in that book and to really sort of leave people with some tangible takeaways of how they really can future-proof their careers, their organizations, their companies. But before we go into all of that, can you give a bit of a background? Because your career journey, your skills and expertise has led you to be able to write such a phenomenal book. So over to you. Where did all of that knowledge come from?
So I thought I wanted to be a management consultant way back then when, and I was about to finish my undergraduate degree. I was in Los Angeles, California. I'd won a scholarship there. And I really looked up to one of my professors. He'd spent his entire career as a management consultant, very glamorous, flying all around the world, consulting to Fortune 100 companies. And I thought that's what I wanted. And I said, "How do I get to where you are, but faster, obviously?" And he said, "Go do your MBA, join a consulting firm, cut your teeth, you know, work your way up from junior analyst to partner." I was like, "Right, got it." So off I went, did my MBA. And in the middle of my MBA, this is when the subprime mortgage fallout occurred in LA. So it wasn't a great time. Crime shot through the roof. The economy went down. So I thought, you know, maybe that's a sign to come back home to Australia. So I came home, cut my teeth in management consulting and proceeded to be bored out of my mind. So I just felt really empty. I just felt every project was the same. Every client was the same. Just chuck a different low on it. And back then, this is going back 10 years now, change management was only starting to be recognized as a discipline. And I thought, oh, this is interesting because I get bored easily. I need things going on all at the same time. And so with change, it intrigued me. It played to my strengths, developing trust and rapport, analytical ability, razor-sharp communication and engagement skills. And it also meant you had to constantly be on your toes because you couldn't use a cookie-cutter approach. Every company was different. Every culture was different. Every change was different. So I was super intrigued, but I didn't have any experience whatsoever. And so I started as a change analyst and took a massive pay cut, a 40% pay cut, start from nothing. Wow. Did all the crappy jobs, all the crappy work. Did change the ball shapes and sizes, shadowed more experienced change professionals, and just worked my way up with laser-like focus and unshakable discipline. And fast forward 7 years later, I was the youngest GM of change for the biggest gold mining company in the Southern Hemisphere.
Wow. That, and again, that doesn't just happen by accident, right? We don't just fall into these big roles with these huge titles and responsibilities. So you mentioned the word discipline there, something that I do talk about a lot because I think motivation gets you started and discipline is what keeps you going. So how did you stay? Like, did you have like a set goal? Did you know what you were doing? Did you have a vision? Did you have a time frame? What were you sort of like telling yourself every day and week to keep the discipline up?
So I'm a big believer in constantly learning. And I think it's relevant for individuals, it's relevant for teams, and it's relevant for organizations. So my book's called The Future Fit Organization. But if I were to call it The Future Fit Leader, the quote would still be the same. And my favorite quote is from Alvin Toffler. And he said, the literate of the future won't be those that cannot read or write, but those that cannot learn, relearn, and unlearn. So my target was constantly learning. I was just competing with myself. I had a little checklist in my head. For example, types of changes. I wanted to do a restructure. I wanted to do an asset divestment. I wanted to do an ERP, blah, blah, blah. So all these types of changes I wanted to experience and do for myself. And then I started to focus on different industries. You know, I'm very strong in mining and oil and gas. I've done higher ed. So that's what I had in my head in terms of progress.
Let's talk about the whole leadership piece. I want to dive into like organization of things, but I do think that there's a lot of skills that people are going to need to acquire over the next decade. And it sounds to me that you and I have very similar mindsets when it comes to growing, learning. I've always got a book in my hand. I've always got a podcast in my ear. I'm always trying to get that 1% better every day and just those slight edges and go, and like you, not competing with anybody else but myself. Like, how can I be better? How can I show up as my best self? So what do you think, if we sort of think about the future, future-proofing our own careers, what are some of the skills that you believe people are going to need to possess to really get ahead in this new way of working?
I think there's two main areas. And first is the digital literacy, obviously. I mean, we are in a very connected digital world. So this means proficiency in using digital tools, understanding data, how to analyze it, how to manage it, how to store it, staying informed about advancements in AI, in automation, in cloud computing. So these are just some areas you need to keep abreast of, and there's always a new tool to learn. So really being selective about the tools that you want to dive into and making sure that they're relevant for where you want to go and for your career and your industry. The second part of that is relational intelligence, right? The smartest person in the room is not the most successful. It's not the most well-liked either. It's the person with the best people skills. And, you know, I really resent it when people say, oh, soft skills. They're not soft at all. They are critical and they're much harder to build than technical skills. So relationships are everything. They are what's going to help you propel forward at home or in the office. So qualities such as curiosity, adaptability, critical thinking, collaboration, these are crucial in any role. It doesn't matter what degree you've got or where you want to go. These are really important skills that you should start to cultivate now.
I completely agree. And what's really interesting, I love the way you sort of like there's digital and there's relational. What I'm finding, so I've got a tech recruitment company and speak a lot to technical leaders, HR people. And, you know, I sort of mention the word AI and they sort of seem to like quiver, right? I think there's a lot of bigger organizations that are scared of adapting this new technology, you know, like cybercrime and all these sort of things are like, you know, what? So when we talk about, and let's sort of go into your book now and dive into this, because this is what's really fascinating. I know this is what a lot of, particularly my clients and sort of people are going to want to learn. What do you think is going to make the future fit organization? Let's focus on the technical side first and foremost. Like, what are your predictions? Like, you know, how should companies be curious about this new technology? Should they be cautious? Like, what are you sort of like advising and seeing in your space?
So my clients are very large organizations, and what I tell them is to not get caught up in the shiny ball syndrome. Like, there's no point having the newest and best tools and, you know, investing all your money in your tech stack. Sure, you've got the best of the best, but then you completely forget your people stack, because don't forget your tool is only as powerful as the people who are ultimately going to be using them. So there needs to be a balance, and never underestimate the exceptional results people can achieve with less than stellar tools, right? So if you invest in your people, they'll exponentially get you a lot further than if you just got the best tools. Because it's people that comprise an organization at the end of the day. It's people that transform a business. It's people that drive forward this change. So when I think of the future fit organization, the things that they're doing is that they're actually investing in helping their people learn, relearn, and unlearn. They're not just saying, you know, they're giving them the time, they're giving them the money. Like, how all too often, you know, organizations claim to invest in their people, but then there's never any budget. You're never allowed to go to a conference. You're never allowed to go on a training course. So the Future Fit organization is one that continuously learns and adapts.
I completely agree. And on that note as well, from I did a lot of research recently around sort of culture and retention, and it's the companies that reinvest back into their people. They're the ones that keep people so much longer than other organizations. And when we think about how much it costs to hire new people into the business, hiring is such a costly exercise to do. So investing and reinvesting into your people, and if people feel like they're growing and learning on the job, they are going to stay around for a lot longer. And I don't know about you, but from what I can see, that is also going to create a future-proof organization, because if you're constantly competing for new talent and you're constantly in the market, your culture is not going to be very good, and that's going to get out to market. So let's talk about that sort of like retention piece. I'd love to sort of get your thoughts on it, because you did write an article recently around how we can keep especially more women and retain yep. more women in businesses. And I think the future organization is going to be a diverse and inclusive organization as well. What are your sort of thoughts on that?
I love that, because I talk about, you know, this people stack analogy, and most organizations, their knee-jerk reaction is to take people out, right? This person doesn't fit. This person doesn't fit. Can't get us to where we want to go. And to your point, there's so many costs associated with that. It's not just the time of interviewing people or whatnot, but when you get a new person on board, they're not productive on day one. It takes them a few months to ramp up and get used to the way of doing things. So the Future Fit organization is one that takes a longer-term view. So instead of just, you know, cutting people, aka Twitter, don't do what Musk did and fire everybody, they're intentional. They think, okay, what are the critical characteristics and the skills that I need 6 months, 1 year, a few years from now? And how do we build that today? You know, so they identify people that have this growth mindset, that are open to learning, and they take them on the journey with them. So instead of playing Jenga where you're constantly removing blocks, you're playing reverse Jenga. You're actually putting more blocks in, and those blocks are the skills and the emotions and the capability that's required to drive a transformation forward.
From what you're sort of seeing working with, like, obviously, you know, you've worked your way up, you've worked with a lot of leaders, a lot of executives as well. What I sometimes find, like, people are very set in their ways, right? And that it's a lot of people fear change, but change, as we know, is the only constant in life. And I think we're going to go through a rapid pace of change over the next decade. I think we're going to see more change in the next 10 years than I've probably seen in my whole lifetime. How can we prepare for that? How can leaders prepare for that? Because obviously they need to be leading by example. They need to be seen to be embracing this change, not fearing it, to then motivate and drive the team's initiative and goals and targets and things. So advice for, like, managers, leaders that are looking after teams of people, how can they embrace change and not be afraid of it? And yeah, any advice about how we can navigate this new world that we're going into?
So people fear change because they don't want to lose anything. And we are very much driven by cure instead of prevention. I mean, the whole healthcare industry is based on that. And so in my experience, they fear change because they're losing one of these six P's, I call it. P, power. Does this change mean I'm going to have less budget? Do I look less powerful? Two is prestige. Maybe it's a restructure. Maybe this person thinks they're going to lose their, I don't know, their car bay, right? You never underestimate how much small things matter to people in terms of their self-essence. Protection. So this person could be an underperformer that's being protected by somebody. Pay, obviously, people are scared it's going to hit them in the back pocket. Position. So does this mean I'm going to be out of a job? So often people are scared of one or more of these things. And as a manager, it's up to you to kind of be proactive and think how this person may be experiencing communication of this change. So if they can provide confidence and assurity that that's not under threat, people will be more open to it. And, you know, managers have a difficult job, especially mid-level managers, because usually the change is pushed down by the top and the expectation is for them to fully support it and lead other people through. But often no one's taking the time to have that conversation with the middle managers and say, hey, this is for the good of the company. You're not losing your job. We're going to do this and this to support you. So that step is often done and not done. And then you have what a lot of people call the permafrost layer, the middle layer. But that wouldn't be there if we actually took care of our people properly.
Look, I completely agree with you. And I think communication is absolutely key when it comes to any sort of like change, especially when like companies go through like mergers and acquisitions, you know, like people don't communicate, people end up leaving, and then the culture just completely falls apart. But like, I do think when it comes to like change management, yeah, that whole sort of communication piece is absolutely key. But for whatever reason, people do struggle. And look, and I get it, because I've struggled before with like that whole like radical candor and just being truly honest and open and almost being vulnerable as a leader. There's a new word that didn't often come up in leadership before, but now like the future leader is vulnerable and honest with their team. But why do you think it's so hard for people to sort of like open up? Should we be opening up more? Should we be bringing that sort of more emotional intelligence and those sort of, again, softer skills, but not really softer skills, really important skills? Why do you think it is so hard for people to communicate and be honest in sort of the world that we're living in right now?
We weren't taught this in schools. Like it would have been so much easier if we were given the language of emotions and taught how to have open, constructive conversations, and it doesn't feel safe, and we can't be expected to learn how to have these conversations overnight if we've never been taught. So, for example, Norway, they're taught EQ skills right from primary school, and you know, when they have a conversation, you'll find that there's less flare-ups, there's less tension, because it's just water off a duck's back. They're used to it. We're not used to it. I'm certainly not used to it. It takes me, you know, a few moments of, I would say, centering myself before I know what is going to be a tense conversation to make sure that I manage my fight or flight response. And also with these particular leaders, they're usually quite senior in their careers, and they've been doing things a certain way and have been rewarded for doing that, by the way. And so for them to totally shift gears and to do something totally different, it just feels like one step too far.
100%. And what I also find as well, and this is kind of like the organization's fault, but a lot of people get promoted into leadership roles and team roles with no prior experience. And all of a sudden, because they've been a high performer or have done well at their day job, they're like, right, now you're going to move into this manager role, this leadership role. And they're just left to their own devices with no support. And it's almost like they suddenly got to learn how to have hard conversations and sort of be put in this position where they got to motivate other people. Like, so advice for new managers and leaders, there's a lot of people that have been, you know, recently promoted out there. Like I speak to a lot of them and they've suddenly got a team of 10 to manage underneath them. They've got no experience. Like what do you think like they should be working on when it comes to like, yeah, leading and motivating a team?
Well, first of all, I think they should ask for support from their organization. They can't just be thrown in the deep end and expect to be an A-plus performer like they always have. For me, the qualities of, if I think of those leaders that have successfully motivated their followers to follow them, to, you know, into very innovative territory, high risk of failure, but they still got people to follow, they have a few qualities. They're really visionary, so they're very good at storytelling. They tell them, this is where we're going and we're doing it all together. So they're very good at that, very articulate. And they communicate in a way that's flexible. They can communicate with other board, they can communicate in the boardroom, and they can communicate in the shop floor. Number two is adaptability and resilience. So they show that they're open to change themselves. They have a positive attitude. And most importantly, they're willing to adjust. It's not just my way or the highway. It's like, here's what I think. What do you guys think? I'm open to hearing what you think, and let's do all this together. And that can help inspire their teams to try, iterate, and fail as well. They usually have very good relational skills, so they can not just are aware and understand their own emotions, but they can identify what's happening in others. So very good at that, I'd say, reading the room. So reading body language, reading the room. They have strategic agility. So one of the worst things a leader can do is not make a decision. And the impact of that, people get frustrated. And often the fallout that happens because of the delaying decision was much worse than if they had chose a decision in the first place. So I think, especially in disruptive times of today, being decisive and confidently decisive is even more important. And last but not least, our global and cultural acumen. We're a multicultural society. People from all walks of life live here, work here, different religions, different ethnic cultures, etc. So to have an understanding and a sensitivity of those and locally adapting that is very important to not just being diverse, but being inclusive, helping people feel respected and valued.
I'm nodding my head for those that are listening to this on the audio because I'm just smiling because this is something that I, again, like people listening to this podcast will know I'm very passionate about. Just, yes, the diversity piece, but the inclusion piece. And what I see happen is companies will come to, for instance, myself and the team and say, we want to hire more diversity into our business. And, but then they haven't got the internal piece right. The culture's just not set up. So diversity is one thing. Inclusion and belonging are two very separate things. So when you are sort of like thinking about, you know, that those sorts of cultures and how we can sort of really set people up for success, any advice for companies that want to really build out inclusive workplaces? Is there some key things that you've noticed that work really well, like when it comes to that sort of supportive culture where everyone feels like they're just set up for success?
I'll tell you what hasn't worked. In very command and control, kind of aggressive, high pressure cultures that I've been in, success and what people are rewarded for, if all fits into one stereotype, it's usually very aggressive, speak your mind, brash, always talk over people in meetings. And so if you don't change what you're holding up as ideal behavior in the organization, people are never going to feel included. And often, huge generalization, obviously, but people from Asian backgrounds, usually more conservative, more introspective. And it used to annoy the bejesus out of me when, like, they'd be like, they'd mistake my thoughtfulness for either aloofness, arrogance, or incompetence. Like, oh, you must not understand. Or like, no, I just don't need to hear the sound of my own voice all the time. But that sort of thinking is pervasive, that, you know, by it's a very Western way of rewarding people.
Yeah, you're so right. And I think what's also rewarded in a lot of businesses is how much you're at your desk and, you know, sort of being seen to be busy. And there's a difference between being busy and being productive. They're two very different things. And what I've often found as well is if I'm just busy being busy, I'm actually not productive. So it's like, you know, you could go up to somebody and they go, oh, I've had such a busy day, but they can't actually tell you what they've done in the day. They can't pinpoint the outcome that they've had and achieved. So it is so important. But one thing that keeps on coming up and I'm reading a lot about is the whole sort of mental health piece. When we sort of think about the rapid pace of change, technology, social media, like all of these things that are coming at us, like I just sort of reflect on our society sometimes and I just go, our brains are not set up for the fast-paced world that we are currently living in. What's your thoughts on this? How can people protect their well-being, their mental health? Should we do digital detoxes? Should we find a way to like decompress, meditate? What do you personally do as well? I'd love to sort of know how you sort of switch off and your journey if with like mental well-being and how you've managed that throughout, you know, your career.
I'd say you're definitely not imagining things. our ability to absorb information is 2.5 times less than pre-pandemic levels. So that's a fact. That's in the Australian Institute of Management. It's because our they call it our surge capacity. Because we were in a state of emergency for 2 years, it's been zapped. And that's why we feel even more overwhelmed today. And repercussions on mental health, definitely social media has a part to play in that. So for me personally, I don't do a full-on digital detox, but I am very mindful of what I consume and I pay attention. If I I'm scrolling through something and I think, you know what, I don't even know why I'm following this account because it actually doesn't make me feel good about myself, I'll actually unfollow. So it's not regimented, but I'd say I go through this process like every 2 months or so to just say, hey, are my habits serving me right now? Do I need to make a shift, etc.? And how I find balance is I try to find the stillness in the chaos. So for me, a lot of my work happens outside of business hours because I've got European clients. So that means the days are like my sacred time. So I get up whenever I want. I have a cup of tea, have my coffee, do Pilates, go for a short walk around the block. So whatever that time is, I make sure I carve that out just for me time. And then I dive into the work stuff. And I also put everything into my diary. Like my personal commitments are just as important as my business commitments. So if I've scheduled myself in to do yoga class, then no, I'm not taking a meeting with a CEO. No matter who that person is, you know.
Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. I wanted to quickly pop in and talk to you about our amazing supporter, CH Talent Solutions. We are an IT and digital recruitment company based in Australia. If you are someone right now looking for a new opportunity or considering a career pivot, please reach out to one of our consultants. Or if you are somebody looking to build your team or build your company or scale, again, please reach out to us if you are looking to find the best tech talent fast. I look forward to connecting with you. Now back to today's episode. Enjoy. That's so good. And it's so important to have those boundaries. Like, for example, like, I think also knowing your values as well. I think values are really important. One of my values, health, growth, they're sort of top two, but health is, because I know that health is the foundation, right? Because if I don't have my health, nothing else matters. Like if I got a diagnosis tomorrow, my business, the podcast, everything, I wouldn't care. Yeah. All I'd be caring about was getting better. And what you said at the start was so powerful. You said, you know, we're so busy worrying about, like, you know, the symptoms, but we've got to start treating the cause. And a lot of these illnesses and diagnoses, they can be prevented if we just start paying more attention day to day to our mental, physical, emotional, spiritual well-being. It's something I am very passionate about. And, you know, stress and anxiety, it's just absolutely rife in our society right now. And to be honest, I think it's just going to keep on getting worse, because if we don't learn to look after ourselves and prioritize our well-being, we really are going to be on a highway for burnout, exhaustion, and disease. And yeah. God, that sounds really awful, but it's the truth. And I think we need to be aware of the warning signs and actually, instead of glamorizing busyness and hustle, we actually need to start talking more about mental well-being and self-care, because otherwise we're all just going to end up like burnt out zombies, and it's not, then we've got no future-proof organization because everyone's exhausted.
So
I think it's really important what you just said there about, even if it's a CEO, you're doing that yoga class. That's just a really important message for people to hear. For sure.
It's like nothing's ever life or death unless you're like an ER surgeon.
Correct.
Cork and wait, you know, no one's going to die in a ditch. Yeah.
Exactly. That meeting can wait. But look, I would love to like dive into the process now of you writing this book. Like, where did all of us, like, did you just wake up one day and go, I'm just going to write a book? Like, what was that process like of going about writing?
So I did a TED talk last year. And the TED Talk is about digital transformation, and it went really, really well. Like, it made it onto TED.com, and a lot of people have found me through that talk. And I noticed everybody wanted to know more. It's like, what did you mean by prism? What did you mean by production? Can you give me an example? And I thought, my God, if I'm having this many inquiries over a 15-minute talk, I should just turn it into a book. That was my thinking. A few years ago, I did try to write a book, and I think because I didn't have the right structure, I just got overwhelmed, and instead I turned it into an ebook, which is still available today on my website. But I realized writing blog posts and articles is very different to writing a book, and I had bitten off more than I could chew. But this time, I noticed the structure that some of my favorite business books followed. And once you have the structure down pat, it makes it a lot easier. And when I was thinking about what do I write about, I literally put a bunch of post-it notes up on the wall, 15 post-it notes. And for each 1 minute of my TED talk, I wrote about what was the point of that 1 minute. And I looked back and I thought, oh, each minute can be turned into a chapter. So my 15-minute talk is now a 15-chapter book. So that's how it started.
Wow. So, okay, so you've got it all mapped out, which is one thing, because that's kind of like the idea phase. The execution is quite the other. So how did you fit it in your schedule? Because like I said to you to start with, like I do a blog and I do like the podcast, and then I think to myself, oh, I really one day would like to write a book. And I'm like, where would I fit that in? So how did you, again, discipline, you know, time management, all those things. Yeah. How did you do it?
So I'm going to tell you, you can have everything you want, just not at the same time.
Oh, okay. I love that. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I knew I wanted a book this year. And so I made the space. I didn't take on consulting clients for 5 months. I didn't run workshops. I didn't speak. I just bunkered down. That was my goal, and I wanted it done this year. So, it's like these organizations, these executives that expect people to do more with less. If you think that's ridiculous, you need to apply that same logic to yourself as well. If you want to do this, then you need to stop something over here. Otherwise, you're going to go crazy trying to juggle it all. So that's what I did. I wanted this. I dialed down the other things that I was doing to make room for this and to make sure it's successful. Like when I create something, I put my whole heart and soul into it. I don't kind of release crap into the world. It has to be A grade or I don't release it. And so to get that result, I needed to make room in my life for it.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I think that's really powerful and honest advice, because I think what people tend to do is they just sort of trying to shuffle a few things around, and then they end up overwhelmed, and then they don't put out something to the world that they're really super proud of. And also reflecting as you were saying that, it's like, you know, on a smaller scale, like with the podcast, for example, now I dedicate Mondays to just the podcast, the research, the booking the guests, the, you know, just these little things, like thinking about the edits, where I think we can really pull apart stuff. And because what I was finding is I was trying to do the podcast throughout the week in amongst everything else, and I just wasn't able to just show up as my best self. I just got off a meeting with a client about some recruitment, and I was jumping onto a podcast. I wasn't focused. So I love the fact that you've just said you can't actually, you know, something's got to give. You've actually got to let something go to let something else in. I think what people do is they pick all these things up, but they don't put other things down. And that's how they start to get like overwhelmed. Yeah. And I've certainly been there before. So I love that. So leads me on to another question that I ponder over a lot. Do you think this whole work-life balance piece is achievable? Or do you think people are setting themselves up to fail, trying to strive for perfect balance? Do you think there is such a thing, or do you think like life ebbs and flows, and sometimes, you know, we're sort of busier over here and we're fuller over there? Like, what's your thoughts?
I don't think there's any such thing as balance. I think it's more blending, really, because work is such a big part of our lives, especially during COVID. Like, it just felt like you were constantly working. So I think trying to find balance is like wishing there was a unicorn. Like it just doesn't exist. I think you just got to do what works for you. Be honest about how much you can take on. Be honest about what's your non-negotiables and what you're willing to compromise on. And I'm a big believer in task batching and time blocking as well. So yeah, if it's important to you, you got to make time for it. Because what's that? I can't remember who said it about the analogy with the rock. Put the big rocks in first, big rocks into your jar. So the big rocks are the important things. Like, for example, you know, your kids' netball practice, you know, Steerco meetings, etc. And then the smaller rocks you fit in after that into the jar. But you got to put the big ones in first. Otherwise, there's never going to be enough room for everything.
People are probably trying to shove too many big rocks in all at the same time, and then wonder why they've got these plates spinning in the air and something's, you know, comes crashing down. So, and usually it's you know, themselves getting pushed to the bottom of the barrel, and then they wonder why they're exhausted and they've got no then energy to show up as their best selves from a work capacity, a leadership capacity, a parenting capacity. So again, sort of coming back to that sort of self-care piece, it is so, so crucial. One of the other things that I was really inspired by when I was sort of looking into like your journey and everything you've achieved is you've got a very incredible, strong personal brand. And this is something that I sort of spoken to a few people about on the podcast, but I think your brand in particular is very strong. So you talked to just then about like batching and doing all these things. And like, you know, so tell me a little bit about the journey of like putting yourself out there more. Like, have you always done that? And because a lot of people say to me, oh, I really know like I should put myself out there a bit more and I really want to build my personal brand, but I don't really know where to begin. Like, what advice would you have for people who want to have a personal brand, and where did you begin?
I just started 3 years ago. So I didn't realize the importance of a personal brand until I started my own business. So my only regret is not starting earlier. So for everybody that's listening on the call, today's the day. Today's the day that you do something.
Do that post.
Yeah, do that post. How did I start? I know my strengths, etc., but there's nothing hearing it from other people and your community. And because I'm a very well-planned and thought-out person, I actually sent a survey out. I sent a survey to about 100 people. So a mixture of friends, colleagues, previous bosses, and people that don't know me very well at all. So I wanted a 360 degree view. And I asked questions like, what do I do Head and Shoulders better than anyone else? What do you think is extraordinary about me? How would you describe me in 3 words? And that sort of stuff. And the answers that came back were quite enlightening. And what's most enlightening is the answers from the people that don't know you very well, because it's all based on perception and what they see online. Anyway, that formed the basis of my personal brand. And I learned to cultivate those qualities because that's what people saw as valuable and that's what people saw as rare about me. In terms of transmitting that brand online, I was quite retrospective about this. So I thought about it a lot. And at first, it's all about what do you want to talk about? What do you want to be known for? And so for me, my pillars are leadership, inspiration/motivation, change management, obviously, and diversity and inclusion. So once you know your pillars, you know what you're going to talk about. So when you see me posting stuff on LinkedIn or writing articles for Smart Company, I'm always talking about one of those pillars. So without pillars, you're just going to talk randomly about anything and everything and you'll appear scattered. So once you know your pillars, you then think about what qualities you want to exude. You know, is it you want to be funny? Is it you want to be intelligent? So once you know how you want to be perceived, you then can create content that reflects these qualities. So if you don't know what they are, again, your content is going to miss the mark. So I was quite intentional with that. And I wouldn't be where I am today if I didn't start investing in my personal brand. So, Georgie, I'm actually working on my second book. I've been signed by Penguin Random House, so second largest book publisher in the world.
Congratulations. That is huge.
Thank you. and it's all to do because they looked up my personal brand and they're like, yep, correct. She's got the creds. She's got this. And it was as simple as that. I mean, I'm a completely unknown author to them. And they had faith in me and just backed me all the way.
That is absolutely incredible. And if ever there was a success story of why to start, that's it. But look, I love actually what you just did there with the pillars, because that's exactly what I did. When I sort of got some advice from somebody that had built a really strong brand, they said to me, what do you want to be known for? What do you want to talk about? But also like what lights you up? Because, you know, you've got to be passionate about these topics. Otherwise you'll lose the motivation. So for me, it's mindset/motivation, career, D&I. Technology, right? They're the sort of the four pieces that I really enjoy speaking about. Like, been in recruitment now for 10 years, so I can offer quite a lot of, you know, value as well. But the other piece to it as well is what I sort of get, where people get stuck is, well, why would anyone listen to me, Georgie? And I always
all the time. They're special. They don't think they're unique. Correct.
What advice would you have for those people that are like, I'm listening to this, I want to get started, but why would anyone listen to what I've got to say?
I actually teach this in my workshop. And so one of the exercises that I get people to do is write a 60-second elevator pitch about themselves as if they were introducing themselves. And I remember this was a very large engineering company and I had a lot of mid-career professionals in the room. And one of them in particular, I won't name names, but he was saying, I work in construction. I'm an electrical engineer. Da, 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 da. I said, well, tell me more. Like, you know, what makes you you? And then he mentioned, oh, I guess I spent, you know, 5 years in JB Hi-Fi and I got, you know, a bunch of customer service awards. And I said, that's great. And he goes, who cares about JB Hi-Fi? And I said, you don't understand the combination of being an electrical engineer and your parents both working in construction combined with your A-plus customer service. That's rare. Like, that's very client friendly and that's interesting. And he's like, oh, I never thought about it that way. So, you know, there is no other you. There's only one you because you are the combination of your skills, experiences, values, beliefs, education, etc. There's no double. There's no replica. So you are very much unique. You just need to learn how to unpack that and share that with the world.
It's really interesting, isn't it? I think from the conversation I have with a lot of people is it's the fear of what other people will think that holds so many people back. And I always say to people is like, listen, like honestly, people don't care about you as much as what you think. The reality is everyone's so busy that they'll just sort of scroll in. They might see a post. Oh, that was a good post. Like, not like, who cares? Like, people obsess about fear of like what other people think, fear of failure, 100%. Fear of putting themselves out, like imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
And I just, my biggest fear in life is getting to the end of my life and thinking, what if? Regret. Did I live up to my true potential? That fear is far more powerful than what Joe Bloggs thinks of one of my posts, you know? Yeah. And I also say this as well, if you're not in the arena, if you're not like posting, if you're not putting yourself out there, then I'm not going to listen to you and your opinion. If you decide 100%. To come onto my LinkedIn or my Instagram and go comment about something negatively, I actually feel sorry for you if you do that, because what is going on in your life for you to want to do that in the first place? Like, hurt people. But if you are not putting yourself out there because of what someone else is going to think, that is honestly the biggest, like, that upsets me so much, because you are missing out on so many opportunities by not doing it.
100%. Yeah. And what I add to that is don't let like the two or three idiots spoil it for the thousands of other people that are really positive, really welcoming. And a massive tribe is out there waiting for you and you're worried about these two, three naysayers. Like, it doesn't make sense, you know?
Correct.
And look, I get a lot of trolls as well and I get a lot of unwanted messages, feedback, blah, blah, blah. But you just got to remember whose views are important to you. Like, not some random on the other end of a keyboard in God knows where, like trolling away on his keyboard. Like, just know whose views matter to you. I mean, these people don't pay your grocery bills. They don't put a roof over your head. Who cares what they think? And like you said, if they're not in the arena getting their butts kicked either, then I'm not interested in your opinion. Thanks very much.
Correct, 100%. Well, I'll definitely come to you for an opinion on my brand if I ever want some questions. They were like, hey, what do you think of this? So I'll ask you, because you're in the arena, definitely on the floor of the arena. But look, you said something at the start that I just really want to sort of touch upon and really pull apart, because you did say how much you invest in your growth and your learning. And I'd love to know, I'm just generally curious as well, what you personally do to keep on growing, keep on learning and keep on, you know, staying ahead of all these trends so you can give value back to the marketplace. Anything that you do on a regular basis?
Much like you, I read quite a bit. So I've always got a book on the go. Every year I'll learn something new. So I think last year it was the Emotional Culture Deck Facilitation course. Next up on my list, I'm keen to do the Brené Brown Daring Greatly course, so something like that. And you know what? It doesn't always have to be so businessy. Like 3 years ago, I took a fashion illustration course just to get my creative juices out there. So it's not always related to what I do for work, but I'm always doing something.
I just think it's so important to keep the brain engaged and, you know, like you say, that creativity and learning and growth, and you just feel so good about yourself afterwards, right? When you're sort of learning and growing constantly. And yeah, it's just so important. But I'd love to know, I mean, I don't know if you can say anything about the next book, the title, but like, what is going to be like next for you? What are you working on? What are you excited about? Yeah, over the next sort of like, you know, year and beyond.
The title is a work in progress, but I'll tell you what the approved sort of concept is. So my first book, The Future Fit Organization, it's very much with a Western context in mind. So I've worked for global organizations. They're usually American or Australian. And the strategies that I put in that book, they wouldn't fly if it was in China or if it was in Japan, et cetera. And I think, you know, we miss a lot of these cultural nuances. And so in true D&I style, I pitched the Future Fit Asian Organization to Penguin. And they thought it was a brilliant idea. So, you know, multi-generational and multicultural workforce, how do you lead them through disruptive times? How do you instill trust and rapport when you can't speak the same language, when you, you know, you don't have a common terms of reference? So how do you harness that melting pot of diversity so it actually accelerates, not erodes your transformation?
So interesting. And I can see why Penguin were like, great idea, let's do that.
There's literally no other book like it on the market, because I did a lot of research. Yeah. Like, is there something already out there? Yeah, there isn't.
Correct. Look, final thing that I'd love sort of like ask you, because you do come across as very confident, very assertive, very sure of yourself, which is so inspiring. I called this podcast Career Confidence for a reason, right? Because I do think that a lot of what we do and what we sort of go on to achieve in life is backed by this belief that we can go on and do the things that we say we want to do. And a lot of that comes from confidence and courage just to put ourselves out there and do these things. But when you sort of reflect back on your career and where you are today, like you've done a TED talk, which would put the fear into most people. Like, I mean, I'm honestly like, you know, I did Toastmasters years ago because I honestly couldn't stand up in a room and say my name. I was so nervous about public speaking, and I've worked on it and I've got a podcast. But what do you sort of like think, you know, were you always confident as a child, or have you worked on that? Would you define yourself as confident? Like, yeah, what's your view on it?
It's funny because I don't define myself as confident, but people always tell me I am and they're drawn to it. I think for me, there's two parts. There's looking confident and there's sounding confident. So I think if you're holistic and you tackle both elements, you'll come across as confident. And for me, looking confident is about eye contact. So I had to get used to that, you know, growing up. You know, from a conservative Asian family, like eye contact was frowned upon, but I learned how to hold gazes comfortably. Sounding confident would be using pauses, so not having to rabbit on so much, using silence and being very comfortable with silence to emphasize your point. People that vary their speaking pace also come across as confident. And people always ask me, but how do I know how to do this? It's like, well, pay attention to the story that you're trying to tell. Like if you're coming up with a list of five things, then go through that really fast, but then pause, go really slow at a big point that you want to make. So, you know, all these things, no one's born with them. For me, I had to practice. You know, you talked about the TED Talk and people always rave about that TED Talk. I didn't just wake up and do a TED Talk. You know, the TED Talk is a result of 3 hours of practice every single day for about 6 weeks. That's why it's perfect. And so I've always been a big believer in practice, practice, practice. I think a lot of people get nervous, et cetera, because you haven't practiced enough. Like I did it so much. I still remember it word for word to this day, like a year later. And it's because I've built that muscle memory. So if you want to be confident, you got to practice. You got to know your stuff. You got to rehearse, seek feedback. Don't underestimate the power of silences and also gestures. The really influential and charismatic politicians do this very, very well. So do a bit of research on that. And because there's nothing like when the power of your words matches the power of your presence. And that's when you're going to be really unstoppable.
Very, very, very well said. I absolutely love that. And I also love just how you said that you practice for 3 hours for 6 weeks, because this is what people don't see. They don't see what goes behind. Oh, she did a great TED talk. Yeah, because of this. Oh, she's got a great business. Yes, because of this. Oh, because she was a yes, but there's so much to those achievements. And that's so important for people to hear and understand. These things don't just happen. Personal brand, the Penguin deal came out of you putting yourself out there consistently every single day on LinkedIn, showing up. And I think that we do sort of live in a society where we look at other people's successes and we go, oh, it's easy for them or lucky them. But what we don't realize is that it's taken years of refining our craft and having the courage to do tough things and put ourselves in uncomfortable positions where we have to get better in order to do these things well. So I think that's just a really, really powerful message to end on. But yeah, look, it's honestly been so great to have you on. And I have got no doubt that you are going to be just absolutely blowing up over the next sort of few years, and your book next, but it's going to be a huge success. But for those people, like, we'll put your book in the show notes below so they can go grab a copy of that. But where can I send people to find out more about yourself and your books and all of the amazing work that you're doing?
My website is freshbyfriska.com, and you can dive into the vault of content that I've been creating for the past few years at LinkedIn. So linkedin.com/in/Friska.
Amazing. We'll make sure all the links are below. But thank you so much for coming on today. It's been an absolute honor. I've loved chatting with you, and I'll have you on when your next book comes out and we'll have a chat about that. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Georgie.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you've got this far, that honestly means the world to me and lets me know that you've got a lot of value from today's episode. So if I could just ask you to do one thing, pull out your phone and please leave a quick review. It honestly would mean the world to me. It will help this podcast grow and get our message out there to more people. So if you could do that for me, that would be amazing. And please reach out and just let me know what you want to hear more about, what you're interested in. It will just also help me make sure that I'm continuing to speak to topics that are relevant and also find guests that are real true experts in what you want to know more about. So have an amazing day. Thank you so much for doing that. And I can't wait to share the next episode with you.